So I just would like to welcome everyone who has joined us to this webinar. Today I am very, very happy and proud to have Dr. David Schechter and Arnold Block, LCSW, joining us. It's exciting for me to have Dr. Schechter because he is one of the very first TMS doctors to, besides Dr. Sarno, who started publishing materials. And so the materials that he published were important for me in my recovery. As I was recovering, I made good use of his workbook. I didn't get as far through it as I probably should have. I guess I'm just not much of a journaler, but the CDs I found very helpful, and the DVD as well. So it's exciting to have him here. I've met him before at a conference, at two conferences, in fact, one TMS conference out in Michigan and another one out in Ann Arbor. So I guess who shall I hand the microphone off to? Let me just announce that Phil Chow, MD, has also joined us, and I have just unmuted him. Dr. Schechter, do you want to start?
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate you setting this up and all the great work you do on behalf of the PPD and TMS community with the wiki that you've been working on.
It's a pleasure.
For a long time. This is Dr. David Schechter. Do we have any idea how many people are currently in on the call?
Well, see, it changes as time goes on. I'd say about 14. Though as I think about this, I think it's mostly for the recording that I'm interested.
Right. And I'm looking at this basically that we have two audiences. We have the people who are currently on with us today and, of course, people who will be listening to in the future. So I'll be directing our comments to both of those audiences. And I thought we'd start off by briefly, you know, just extending our introduction a little bit. I appreciate the kind introduction by Forrest, which is that, you know, my work with TMS goes back 30 years now. I met Dr. Sarno as a medical student. I was having knee pain. This is described on my website and some of my other materials. It's certainly no secret. And I was expecting to get some physical therapy from Dr. Sarno because I knew he was a rehabilitation doctor, and he was not known yet as the guru of the mind-body syndrome. So I went into him for this knee pain, and he said something to me that I think influenced my career and probably influences it almost every day for these last three decades, which is, he said, 95% of this chronic pain stuff is psychosomatic. What do you think about this, young man? And again, I was a very young man at the time. And so I was a little skeptical, as maybe some of you are when you first hear about this, because this was not what I was expecting to hear from this NYU professor of rehabilitation medicine. But he said to me, well, if you think this is something you'd be interested in hearing more about, come to my seminar. And he was doing regular seminars and lectures for his patients. I was not yet a patient of his, but he invited me to the seminar. And I went to the seminar the following Monday. And as he laid out and presented his ideas in this slideshow, well before there were PowerPoints, it began to make sense to me. And it was he did a very clear job of explaining it, and I began to see myself, as many of you have seen yourselves in the books that Dr. Sarno has written. I began to see myself in the descriptions that he would describe of this condition. And lo and behold, by the time I left that evening, an hour and a half later, and went back to my small apartment in Manhattan, I felt a weight lifting off of me, because like many of you, I had felt very burdened, both physically and emotionally, by having what was then becoming chronic pain. You know, it wasn't as long as many of my patients, but it was certainly in the many months of pain. It wasn't just a few weeks or anything like that. And that sense of a weight lifting off of you, of having a hope, was the beginning of my recovery, which occurred rather rapidly over the next number of weeks and into the next couple of months as I resumed my physical activities that I wanted to and as I was eventually examined by him, et cetera. And so this incredible experience that I had as a patient of his led me to explore this work further with being his research assistant and spending a whole summer with him, where I got to see patients as he saw patients, and I got to do telephone follow-up, and really sparked my interest further in this as I continued through medical school and into residency, moved out to the West Coast, but eventually reconnected with Dr. Sarno, and and started doing a lot more of this work as he became more well-known as a result of his publications, his books, and written up in various magazines and things. He started referring his West Coast interested people to me, and I really started to develop a practice in this area, which has continued to this very day. I've had the great opportunity to work with a number of talented psychotherapists over the years, and I want to honor Donald Dubin, the first one, who was a substantial contributor in this field and passed away a couple of years ago. And I invited Arnold Block today, who was trained by Donald Dubin, because I felt like he could offer a lot to this this audience with his insights into the psychological aspects of the tension myositis, tension myoneural, and psychophysiological disorder syndrome. And I'll call it that interchangeably, but won't use the full list of diagnoses each time. And so my work in Los Angeles consists of general medicine, sports medicine, pain medicine, but with a focus on the mind-body aspect of things. And almost every day I see patients with this condition, and every month I have dramatic success results with patients. Not everybody succeeds, but a lot do, and it's very rewarding. I want to briefly pass the microphone, so to speak, over to Arnold Block, someone I've worked with for about 6 years on a referral basis, referring him patients, and he's done wonderful work both in person and more recently on the telephone and on Skype with patients with this syndrome. And I think, Arnold, I'll give you a chance to tell us a little bit more how you got interested in TMS and some of your general thoughts in this area.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fechter. I'm a clinical social worker. I have been in practice for about 26 years. And like many of the practitioners in this field, I have been someone who was suffering from pretty severe TMS symptoms initially without really knowing it. I had severe back problems. I would have back spasms 3 to 4 times a month and be completely incapacitated. Some of you out there might know what that feels like. And I had seen chiropractors, I'd seen acupuncturists, I had had the full gamut of all kinds of evaluations and treatments, but nothing really was helping me. And then I came across John Sarno's work and was referred to Don Dubin, whom Dr. Schechter just referred to a little while ago. And despite my having been in therapy many times to deal with various issues, I did get into some specific issues with Don Dubin involving perfectionism, carrying the world on one's shoulders, so to speak, and began to see with Don Dubin's help some of the necessary connections between my own perfectionism, the demands that I placed upon myself on a daily basis, and these back spasms that I was having. And so for those of you who are skeptical out there, and I know that initially when you begin to hear about this paradigm, it does seem like a stretch, because we've generally been encouraged in our culture to think of pain as having a predominantly physiological source. So I want to testify for those of you who might still be skeptical that there is relief available, and I found myself, as I began to deal with some of my own perfectionism and began to change the way I was living my life, the back spasms went away, and I'm happy to say I haven't had one of those now in many years. And so it gives me a lot more confidence to be able to work with people in this field, having actually been through recovery myself. And I've probably over the past 5, maybe 6 or 7 years seen maybe close to 100 or so, maybe more TMS patients, and helped them to take a look at emotions that they're repressing, take a look at their perfectionistic personalities and the demands they place on themselves and other things which I'm sure we'll get into further in tonight's discussion.
Well, Arnold, you brought up a couple of general principles, and as I see some principles in there, I think I'll just point them out. One principle you brought up was that, you know, quite a few of the practitioners in this field have themselves been helped by this methodology. And, you know, that points to the fact that one just has a little bit more empathy and more understanding of both the condition and its treatment if you've been through it yourself. But certainly it's not a necessity. There's plenty of obstetricians who haven't had delivered a child themselves yet. But the other principle you brought up was that psychotherapy, which is something that, you know, is good for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons, sometimes general psychotherapy doesn't work to fix a TMS condition or a chronic pain condition or a PPD condition, but it has to be working with someone who really can hone in on the important issues, and progress is much faster for a number of reasons that hopefully we'll get a chance to talk on, we'll get a chance to address during the course of this this hour or so. But, you know, some therapy is better than any therapy, but focused therapy by someone who's an expert in this, I think, is much more dramatically effective. And I've seen this over the years in patients I see who already have been in therapy but haven't yet seen a TMS practitioner. So that's another principle that I wanted to briefly bring up. I wanted to also welcome, as did Rob, Phil Chow. Phil is a resident in family medicine in Erie, Pennsylvania, and he spent a rotation with me about a month or two ago in Los Angeles to learn more about TMS. And I just wanted to acknowledge him, and he may also have some comments to make throughout the course of the call or questions to ask, et cetera. And he's a practitioner who's you know, learning more about this and delving into it, and hopefully we'll be able to utilize it in his practice as well. I'm proposing at this point to open it up for some questions that you might have. The kinds of questions that would be ideal, of course, are more general questions or questions that you might have about yourself, but something that we could then generalize from, because obviously we can't diagnose or treat based on this this format. But we're glad to answer questions, comment, et cetera. So this is your opportunity now to ask a question. I don't know how we have to, do you have to write that in or?
So the way we handle questions, for people who are not yet in the chat room, you want to go to tmswiki.org/chat. And then if you scroll down a little bit, you'll see a chat room with a bunch of people talking at the bottom. And if you have a question that you'd like to ask, you can either type the question in there and I will read it out, or much better, you can tell me how you're connecting to the call, and then I'll unmute your microphone and you can ask it yourself. It tends to go much better if you join the call yourself, because sometimes when someone types something out in a chat room, it's kind of hard for us to understand. So I really do encourage people to actually join the call.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And I'm also reading the chat room documentation there. So if somebody types something in, I'll see that as will Forrest. And we also have some other things to talk about. So if there aren't questions right off the bat, we have other case examples, anonymous case examples to discuss. And we have some questions that were initially prepared by Phil Chow to work off of as well. So we have a number of different things that we can discuss. But I'm certainly open at this point to a question that might come up.
Excellent. Well, I have to say, I have a question myself. So you mentioned that TMS therapy is different. And I mean, I think of you as basically founding the LA psychotherapy scene. Like, there's so many therapists in LA, so many TMS therapists. And so it seems like you'd have a good perspective on that. Can you tell me a little bit about how it's different?
Well, I'll be glad to do that, and then certainly have Arnold give his perspective as well, because obviously he sees both general patients as well as TMS patients. But when a patient goes to a psychotherapist, in general, the discussion is about their emotional life, their day-to-day, week-to-week existence, relationships, childhood stuff, et cetera. But it tends to, you know, it's free form, and the goal of the psychotherapist is to help the patient understand some of their psychodynamics, some of their stressors, learn different coping skills, etc. But the psychotherapist is not very focused on the physical symptoms that they're having. They're focused on the emotional life, and that's appropriate because that, you know, how we get better from TMS is to focus more on emotional life and situation. But the TMS therapists that I've worked with, in some cases helped train, helped develop over the last 15 or more years in Los Angeles, have been able to do a few things. One is speak the language of TMS. So the language that I'm speaking, which is the language that I learned from Dr. Sarno and from his books, et cetera, is the language the psychotherapist is speaking, is the language the patient is learning. So that common language is very helpful. Second thing is that TMS therapist is doing therapy, psychotherapy, but they're also bringing it back to the pain and bringing it back to the patient's understanding of why they're having the pain. And so it doesn't allow the patient's symptom to sort of hide away in a corner. It becomes overt as to we're trying to get rid of this by working on the emotional issues. And the third part is, I think, the goal-oriented part, which is when you go into psychotherapy, you don't really know what to expect. Well, I want to feel better. I want to understand myself better. And this can go on from anywhere from weeks, months, years, if you're Woody Allen, maybe 40 years. But when you're doing TMS therapy, you have a goal in mind. Your goal is to feel better with your physical symptom, which is often pain, but can be other TMS-related symptoms and equivalents. And so that goal-oriented component, I think, makes the psychotherapy more effective because one, the psychotherapist and the patient and the doctor know if things are going in the right direction based on the potential improvement of that symptom. So those would be the three aspects that I think are different. I'd like to hear from Arnold, if you don't mind me pushing it over from Forrest's question to Arnold, to hear what your perspectives are on the difference between general psychotherapy and TMS-focused psychotherapy.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Schechter. In my work with somebody who has TMS, I'm always making a point to connect anything that we're talking about to their physical symptoms. So keep in mind that, we have to keep in mind Dr. Sarno stressed that it was very important for people to begin, where he talked about believing the diagnosis. And I think we could say that what that means is that in order for there to be relief, the patient has to begin to see the connection between their emotional life, their repression, their way of living, and the physical symptoms they're having. So a very important difference for me when I'm working with TMS and general psychotherapies, whatever is taking place in the discussion, I'm always connecting it back to the symptoms that the person is experiencing. And as soon as they begin to make that connection themselves, then their chances of experiencing relief goes up substantially. So that, I would say, in my mind, is the most important thing that I have to do is to keep coming back to, so they see the pain in the body and they're linking it, because I want them to start to think emotionally about what's going on in their bodies. Anything to add there?
I think that's a great explanation. Forrest, does that answer your question from both of our perspectives?
Absolutely. I mean, it seems like the TMS worldview is so important to reinforce when you're recovering that it seems like that would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent comment. The concept of worldview, you know, relates, I think, to the concept of change in cognition, change in thinking, change in understanding, accepting the diagnosis. All of those concepts are related. And so we are all immersed in a worldview that is structurally based. The media constantly talks about, you know, a new back surgery that came along or a new injection that came along. And many of the other physicians and alternative practitioners that TMS people have seen are focusing on one kind of a supplement, injection, needle, procedure, et cetera, whether they be, again, conventional or alternative practitioners. When you come into the TMS worldview, you're starting to talk about things in a different way. I think a key element of people getting better is learning to change their understanding of their own pain and narrative. And what I mean by narrative is when you come in, you tell the doctor what's been going on the last 3 or 5 or 10 years with your pain, you're telling a story, you're telling a narrative. But the initial narrative many people tell before they understand this condition is a narrative of, I lifted something, or, you know, I fell down, or I hit a tennis ball too hard. And the narrative, as it begins to evolve with the TMS worldview that Forrest referred to, is a narrative that refers to, I was under a lot of stress at that time. There was an issue with my wife and our relationship. I was under financial pressure. My beloved grandmother had died, etc. So the narrative begins to change to focus on the psychological. By having the practitioners all focused on the same, as you said, worldview, it helps the patient to redefine their narrative. And that's how I think people get better. All right.
I would just add as well that the idea that one's body has something to say about the quality of one's emotional and spiritual life is, in my mind, is another important change in the world view that a person, you know, might have. So just to explain further, if you think of your body as giving you trouble, as separate from what's going on mentally and emotionally, that's one paradigm. But if you think of your body as having something, as having valuable information to give you about the quality of your life, that's an entirely different paradigm. So then you begin, one can begin in this paradigm, in the TMS paradigm, to think now that maybe one's body is pointing to necessary changes in one's life. For example, just today, in fact, just a few minutes ago, I had somebody leave the office who, like many TMS sufferers, is somebody who believes that he has to prove something every day about his own worth. And despite having gone to Yale and graduated and achieved considerable success, nothing he does ever feels quite enough. So he spends his day in what I like to call the hierarchical paradigm, where his life is always about having to climb some ladder and having to prove something. Needless to say, he has significant pain in his body because every day his life is spent feeling dissatisfied and having to prove something. So we're beginning now to see if he can change that paradigm and consider other world views or paradigms by which he may, you know, by which he can live his life. And that might be something we could go into a bit further.
Arnold, that's very eloquently stated. I mean, the TMS as a message, the symptom as a message,
yes,
is something that, you know, patients just won't get from other types of practitioners. And what they're getting before that is the symptom as somehow being due to a disease, something that needs to be fixed by a practitioner, again, conventional or alternative. And what we are doing is once we've excluded, Chuck, we'll get to you in just a second, once we've excluded a structural problem, and that's a key element of what the medical doctor does, is, you know, defining that this, in fact, is a TMS condition. Once we've done that, the key focus is understanding that message. And, you know, I use journaling for one of the tools that patients can do that in. Certainly psychotherapy is another one. And listening, just listening closely to the patient. Chuck has a question. I'm wondering if you could, Forrest, if you're still on, if you could allow Chuck onto the live
sure
mic.
I sure am. And Chuck is unmuted.
Hi. You just mentioned the working with doctors to have a correct diagnosis. One thing that I've noticed is that a lot of people don't live near a TMS physician. Are there any tips that they should use in seeing their primary care physician to determine if they have to rule out a serious medical condition to see if TMS is the right approach for them?
Okay, well, you know, that's an excellent question. It's something that I've obviously run into over the years because I started doing my TMS work when it was basically, you know, myself, Dr. Sarno, myself, and just a few others around the entire country. Now, fortunately, there are more, but there's nowhere near enough, and many of you, both listening to this and potentially listening in the future on the wiki, are very far away from a practitioner. So your options are travel to a practitioner who is an expert in this, and sometimes that's feasible and sometimes it's not. In terms of working with your local doctors, you know, you're really looking, it's hard to be your own doctor, but you're really looking to communicate with your doctor in such a way as you find out if they feel like there is a high likelihood of something biochemically or structurally wrong with you, And if they don't believe that, if there any reason why you can't try a conservative program, the term conservative program is well understood by sort of everybody in medicine. It's not a political term, it's just a medical term. Why, is there any reason why you can't try a conservative program that would feature, you know, some, let's say, some mind-body approaches or psychologically based program, or just say a conservative program? And so almost any practitioner who is competent should be able to say to you, yeah, I've examined you, I've looked over your blood tests, your MRI results, and there would be absolutely no reason why you can't try a conservative program over the next couple of months. Now, their choice of a conservative program might be physical therapy, but maybe you've already done that, or maybe you don't want to do physical therapy. So I'm just saying that as long as you're a candidate for a conservative program, meaning you don't need some urgent surgery for a tumor, you don't need medical treatment for rheumatoid arthritis, as long as you're a candidate for a conservative program for your condition, I think you're a candidate to try TMS for a period of time, either on your own, with the help of some of the educational materials that have been developed by Dr. Sarno and other doctors around the country, some of the online materials, et cetera, or just by yourself, with the help of the wiki and other information that's out there. So that's the way I would look at it.
Thank you.
I noticed, this is Arnold Bloch again. I just noticed that looking at in the chat room, that it seemed like a number of people seemed to respond immediately to the idea that they understand the burden of having to prove oneself every day. And so just for those of you who might be listening, you should maybe understand that that is a very common malady, that people carry this burden, and we're saying in the TMS world that this can manifest itself in symptoms, in stress, and it's something you should, you know, you should try to find some help for, because it's a great burden to carry.
And Arnold, similar to that, someone wrote about pressure, and that's often a word that, you know, people can relate to as well, that feeling of putting a lot of pressure on oneself, or feeling a lot of pressure from one's life experiences and work and personal responsibilities, and that, you know, pressure is one of the causes, at least in the short term, of why a TMS prone person might have physical symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we say TMS prone person, I'll just keep speaking because I don't know if there's another question right now, but if there is, certainly go ahead and indicate your interest. But TMS-prone person is someone that I call the type T personality. Dr. Sarno alluded to it in some of his earlier books. And the type T personality to me is basically someone who is a perfectionist, a people pleaser, hard on themselves, highly responsible. Dr. Sarno likes the term goodist. Some of you may relate to that as well. And having these personality traits, not necessarily all of them, but quite a few of them, or one of them very strongly, enables us to experience more pressure than, let's say, the average person would who didn't have quite the same number of these personality traits. And then in terms of what to do about that, maybe I'll pass that on to Arnold or leave that as an open question for later. Arnold, do you have any comment on if you have a TMS personality, and you know you're not going to change your personality, What do you do to feel a little bit better in terms of the physical symptoms and deal with the personality traits?
Well, Dave Clark, who some of you might know, is also a doctor who has made significant contributions in this field. He introduced me at a conference to the simple term self-care skills. He likes to talk about self-care skills. And I thought that there was a very simple way to help people take a look at whether they have good self-care skills and what does that actually mean. And I think it can mean a lot of things, but it would include things like setting realistic goals, being compassionate with oneself, while at the same time striving to achieve the things that might be important to you. The difference between a person who's compassionate with oneself versus being very critical of oneself is huge in terms of how they feel. Other self-care skills might include allowing, I said being patient already, and allowing oneself time to achieve the things that are important. Another thing I would add that I find helpful to teach people is what I call self-soothing skills, because people, it's quite natural for people to feel anxiety, and as many of you might know, anxiety, unfortunately, is one of the most rapidly, I guess you could say, spreading or growing illnesses, certainly in this country, maybe throughout the Western world. And there's a huge increase in the prescription of anti-anxiety medications, and it tells us something about the conditions that we're living in our culture. So if people don't have good self-soothing skills, meaning a way to calm oneself down, a way to achieve relaxation in the middle of a work day, then they're more likely to produce stress symptoms down the road. Some of the more common types of self-soothing skills that are now being taught are meditation, mindfulness, deep breathing, of course, yoga, things of that nature. But I'm also very interested in the relationship that a person has with themselves. I'll say the word again, compassionate. The person who has a compassionate relationship with themselves is much less likely, I believe, to have TMS symptoms.
Very well put. There seems to be another question, Forrest. Do you see...
yes, indeed. That is, in fact, Phil. Do you want to just jump right in?
It's a question for Arnold, Phil, right?
Yes, hi. I'm not sure... Am I unmuted here?
No, you are indeed.
Excellent.
We can hear you.
Okay,
you're actually unmuted throughout the whole call, so don't, you know, let out a big burp or anything, because everyone can hear it.
Okay, duly noted. And so my question here would be more for Arnold's perspective. Hi, Dr. Schechter. It's been a while. Arnold, I was wondering, from your perspective, as somebody who's been doing therapy for a while, how would you legitimize or... I guess the term would be normalize the idea of somebody having a psychologically based condition, not necessarily pain, but psychologically based condition, when you're just introducing the topic to somebody and trying to gain more awareness of that, and perhaps when you're evaluating somebody that you strongly suspect may in fact have a PPD TMS.
I actually had a little trouble understanding the question. Are you saying how would I introduce to them the possibility that they might be suffering from TMS or PPD?
Yes.
When they've actually come to see me about something else. Is that what you mean?
I suppose, but I was also thinking about just in terms of somebody who sought you out perhaps for therapy in general.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay. Well, if I have a strong hunch that we may be actually looking at a TMS case, one of the first things that as an ethical practitioner I need to do is to make sure that they've ruled out any physical causes. So I would usually refer them to Dr. Schechter to make sure that what they're telling me doesn't have any serious physiological etiology. I need to rule that out first. And then if I get confirmation from Dr. Schechter as the MD in Los Angeles that I referred to, then I would feel more comfortable proceeding further, so, having ruled out anything potentially dangerous. And then I might begin to, once I've asked them things about their lives. And of course, I'm thinking about the typical TMS characteristics. Are they a people pleaser? Are they a perfectionist? Are they hard on themselves? These things we've been discussing so far. And if they are, I might say to them, I wonder if you've ever considered the possibility that some of the symptoms you're describing might be a skin condition, might be headaches. I wonder if you've ever considered the possibility that it might be related to your emotional life. And then when I do that, I'm kind of putting out a test, like a litmus test, to see how open to that they are. Because as we know, unfortunately, many people are very resistant to that idea. And if they are highly resistant to it, I might suggest, you might want to do some reading on the subject. I'd give them some books to read. It would be Dr. Schechter's handbook, might be, some of Sarno's books. And I'd say, look, take a look at this, and let's talk further about it next time. So I'm introducing them to the idea, and I know that for some people it's a big leap. Now, some people will immediately say, oh, I have no problem with that. I can see that might be true. So that's pretty much how I would go about it. And if I'm absolutely certain, I might come on a little bit stronger and might say, look, I have to tell you that in my opinion, the symptoms you're describing to me could very well be related to emotional repression or, whatever it is. And then we go from there. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yes, it did. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I don't know, as the host, do you mind if I jump in?
Please.
Because this is something that I've thought about a tremendous amount, and I moderate an email mailing list for TMS therapists, and this is something that a lot of them struggle with as well. When they have someone and they, they want to reach out to them, how do you convince them? Because in some sense, the patient is always the most important person, because if the patient doesn't get on board, then no forward progress will be made. So when I presented at the conference at New York University, I encountered this. I had brought a couple of brochures about the peer network, and I said, to some degree, it is very helpful to lead with a success story. So if you can hand them a brochure and you can say, hey, check this out, investigate, see if this works for you, read some of the stories, see if it resonates. I find putting them in the driver's position can be pretty helpful. And leading with stories, I think, helps people relate. One thing I think is a great resource that hasn't been used in this way, but you can just have them Google Thank You, Dr. Sarno, which will bring them to the Thank You, Dr. Sarno project, which has some incredibly inspiring stories. And that's another way that they can find out about it. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the TMS activist's approach.
I see.
Yeah, this is where when a therapist has their own story to tell, too, it's extremely useful.
Mm.
Right? Because the evidence is sitting right with them in the room.
Absolutely.
Whereas in other kinds of therapy, I'm probably less likely to reveal as much about myself. But in this kind of work, I would definitely make it a point to tell them about my own recovery, because it helps them, it increases their confidence in the process dramatically.
Mm-hmm. And I know, if I can just sort of add a last comment onto that idea. Pardon?
Just keep going.
Okay. I was just going to sort of finish that thought by saying, I know obviously in my training practice, I've definitely come across individuals who I strongly believe, based on my gut feeling, have a TMS PPD. And now that I've worked actually with Dr. Schechter last month, I feel like I have a stronger concept of that and stronger diagnostic sense. However, I tend to want to lead with a little bit of self-revelation about that with the patient. However, I still continue to struggle with trying to, I suppose, come on too strong, and I don't want to. When I am in the room with a patient, I don't want to necessarily give off the impression that I have a particular pulpit to deliver a. I don't know what the word would be, but.
Phil, sometimes you have to preach, and sometimes it's just enough to plant the seed. I cannot tell you how many times I've seen people, when I ask them how they learned about this, they said a friend gave them a book a year ago, and they looked at it and, it didn't seem that interesting. They put it on their bookshelf. I guess now they might just immerse it in their Kindle shelf. But then some reason or another, they picked up the book again, and somehow something had changed inside of them, and they were open to it, and reading the book, let's say one of Dr. Sarno's books, it made sense to them this time, and it prompted them to pick up the phone or the internet or whatever, and they found their way over to me. And so sometimes one just needs to plant a seed. This is also true not just to practitioners, of which I realize there are a relatively small number on this call, but also when you're trying to deal with friends, family members, other people you think might have this condition. You know, there are people that might respond to a very inspirational story or you telling your own story, as Forrest was talking about. But there's other people that might withdraw and might just, you might want to just plant a seed. You know, there's something that is intriguing and here's where you can find out more information about it. And they might not look at it right then, but they might open your email up again 6 months later and look at it. So it varies from time to time, place to place. A person has to be ready to change. And, you know, this kind of relates to the whole psychological change literature as far as when people are able or ready to make a change in their life. And sometimes they're ready and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well said. So based on chat room responses, it seemed like people really connected to what you were talking before about, you know, carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders, the type T personality. Shall we do another case study or another story?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You, Arnold, do you want to share with us? You had a couple of case studies in mind. Do you want to share one of them with us now?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. I mean, one of the most striking and gratifying cases I had was a man in his late 20s who Dr. Schechter referred to me. He was an engineer and one of these very logical people. In fact, one of the first things he said to me when I met him is he said, you know, he admitted to me that it was very difficult for him to buy the whole TMS paradigm because he said, I'm an engineer and, you know, if something can't be proven logically, it's hard for me to believe. So what I discovered about him really within the first session was that he had a way of describing his early life, which was actually a very traumatic early life. He had a way of describing it in a very logical way without any emotions. And any therapist who's had any kind of experience would understand that when a person is describing early trauma as if they're talking about someone else's life without any feelings, you know that there's major repression going on. In his particular case, he was telling me about his mother who was a severe drug addict and how he'd watched her being held up at knife point a number of times during drug exchanges that had gone bad. And as a little child, he was watching this, and also that he had to wake up his little sister in the morning when he was about 8 or 9. He had to wake up his 5-year-old sister to feed her because if he didn't, nobody would. There was no father in the scene. And his mother would be, you know, involved in some kind of drug stupor, so she was unable to feed the child. Now, here's an important point. When I said to him, so what was that like for you to have to wake up in the morning and feed your little sister? He said to me with a blank stare, he said, well, somebody had to. So I couldn't get him to feel the feelings of what he was talking about. Now, there are many different techniques that people use to elicit emotion when you're facing major repression. One of them is called therapeutic astonishment, which means that the therapist plays back to the person what they've just said to you, but with the emotion that the person is lacking. So in this case, I said to him, you had to feed your you were only 8 years old and you had to feed your 5-year-old sister. And I was, you know, horrified at hearing this. And your mother was lying on the couch in a drug stupor. So my point being is I'm signaling to him through my astonishment that this is a very emotionally charged issue. Now, I don't have enough time to explain all the details of the case, but I can tell you that as we got into the second, third, and fourth session, he began for the first time to actually feel the emotions of his early life. And he began to realize that actually he had experienced a traumatic early life. And the great news is that, I mean, I'll never forget the day he walked in, I think it was the fourth or fifth session, and he said to me, I told you, he said, that I never, he said, and in order to believe something, I need to see the facts. And he said to me, I cannot argue with the facts, but the more I talk about my feelings, the better my chest was feeling. I might have forgotten to mention that his symptom was that he had extreme chest pain, so much so that he had seen cardiologists, he had had MRIs, he had had x-rays, and he had dropped most of the things that he loved doing. His cycling, he was too afraid to cycle too far from his house because he was afraid of having a heart attack, even though no one had been able to find anything wrong with his cardiovascular system. So the great news was that he saw that the more he began to actually feel his feelings, meaning he began to cry for the first time, he began to weep about the terrible childhood he had, and his chest pain began to lessen and lessen and lessen. At the end of about 10 sessions, he was back on his bicycle, cycling through the desert where he lives, not afraid anymore to leave his home, not afraid of a heart attack. And the last time I saw him, he was just doing extremely well. So that's a great story I love to tell about the relationship between emotional repression and intense pain. In this case, it was intense chest pain, which was actually crippling his life. He couldn't function properly.
Well, that's a wonderful case success. And it also points out, and I think many of you know this, but TMS, many people think of it as just back pain. Of course, that's probably statistically the most common symptom I see, but so many other conditions that we treat, and this patient had this chest pain. I remember him telling me that he was addicted to success. Both of his parents had been involved with substance abuse, and he had kind of redirected himself to the engineering and the success and all of that, but that tends to not allow enough for the self-care and for the access to the emotional life that Arnold helped him to find, and that helped him to alleviate his symptoms.
Mm-hmm. That's well put.
It does seem like, situations can get in the way of us experiencing our emotions sometimes, like we're under so much pressure and we don't feel like we have time to experience the emotions, especially when, the chronic pain, the TMS itself, has caused so much chaos in our lives that we're just struggling to hold it all together.
Absolutely. And sometimes, survival requires us to just kind of get through a period. That's why I think TMS often comes on not during a stressful period, but it often comes on after the stressful period is over, because we've kind of fought our way through it, and then we're finally getting a chance to sort of recover from it, and that's when there's a little bit of a chance for the whole thing to start creeping in. I have another case here to mention, because, again, I just want to emphasize to people there's a lot of different symptoms that can be successfully treated. This was a gentleman in his, in his 30s, with cluster headaches and migraines, and came to me with both type of headaches. The cluster headache he'd had for about 25 years on and off, and they can get quite severe. And we worked together with TMS and my home program, and what he first noticed was the cluster headaches were moving, which they had never moved before in the previous 25 years. So I find that a symptom, especially a physical pain, that moves to a different area, like upper back to lower back or left side to right side, can be an indication we're beginning to sort of loosen it up and we're beginning to shake up the unconscious component to this. This was someone who had a headache since fourth grade. And after the headaches moved around, very quickly they began to go away. And when I saw him back about 6 weeks later, which was my second visit, they were 80% gone. And at this point, 95 to 98% gone. So just someone with headaches that delved a little bit into the emotional and mind-body triggers and did very well with that. And again, was open to it. The key thing in TMS, and I think this has been alluded to by a couple of people, is having the diagnosis, having the condition, but also being open to the fact that you have it. And sometimes we have to push people a little bit, and sometimes they find it on their own, but that combination is the key element. I see somebody commenting on the chat room with the calm after the storm. And somebody was commenting, is that because the brain has been switched on and it won't switch off? Well, certainly the brain can get switched on. The whole fight and flight system, the autonomic nervous system, can get hyped up during a period of stress and kind of keep us going. It's almost like getting a shot of adrenaline every day. And then finally the stressful period ends and the body stops producing quite as much cortisol and these other stimulatory hormones. And we kind of have to start facing things again. We pull down a little bit, and that's when we are a little bit more vulnerable sometimes to illness or to TMS attacks.
This sounds like it matches my experience exactly, because I was taking care of my mother who had Alzheimer's disease for 5 years. And during that period, I worked two jobs, wrote books, fixed the house, managed several wrongful death lawsuits associated with my father's death that had transferred the responsibility from my mother onto me. And it wasn't until 6 months after my mother died that I began to develop sciatica and lower back pain. But that was exactly when I inherited their house, and they'd had a very conflicted relationship. So I was wondering whether I had switched on that fight-flight freeze mechanism during those 5 years, when I did a tremendous amount. I was a perfect hero. And it still stayed on after my mother's death, and that initiated the biochemical changes that resulted in my having TMS for basically the last 10 years. I seem to be just coming out of it now.
That's a long time. I'm sorry. I'm very sorry to hear that. I'll comment, then I'll give Arnold a chance to comment as well. But as you say, you were the hero. You were taking care of another person. You were taking care of a lot of other business and other matters. Didn't really have a lot of chance for self-care during that time. It just wasn't the nature of your life at that point.
No.
And then when you got through that phase, and then I think that the house ended up presenting a different kind of challenge for you, because it may have, in a sense, compelled you to go into maybe a grieving cycle, or maybe to need to go into a grieving cycle that perhaps you had postponed because of the nature of this terrible disease your mother had, and your need to take care of her. And I don't know, just to speculate, not knowing you very well, and just sometimes delayed grieving or prolonged grieving can be a component of a TMS trigger. I think I'm going to have Arnold now comment, if you would, on any of that from a psychological standpoint.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad Dr. Schechter brought up the word grief or grieving, because that's if in fact you are somebody that did have to put off the grieving because you were in such a coping state, having to solve so many problems around you, then that is something that might have precipitated TMS symptoms. Certainly, my experience has shown me that people who have not grieved the loss of a loved one, or even the loss of maybe a career. We're living in times now where many people have lost their careers. People have also lost their life savings. And if they're not able to grieve, then all that emotion gets repressed and can produce headaches, skin conditions, digestive problems. So that is something you might want to consider then, is have you been able to allow yourself to fully grieve? Let me just add that, and I don't know if Dr. Schechter would agree with this, but I find often that many of the people I meet who have TMS tend to be intellectual people, meaning that they're people who think a lot and solve many problems by working out solutions intellectually or mentally. And we know way back from, the days of Freud, when Freud talked about the different defenses that people use to fend off their feelings of vulnerability, feelings of loss. One of the defenses he talked about was intellectualization. And my experience is that many of the people I see tend to have very strong intellectual defenses. And they find, for the first time in their lives, that they're not able to find an intellectual answer. They can't get a clear answer as to, well, this is the organ that's giving you the problem, or and they get very thrown off. They feel a sense of hopelessness, helplessness, and it's the job of the TMS therapist, I believe, to help people to get more comfortable with feelings of helplessness, feelings of despair, paradoxically, so that they can actually come out the other side of that, feeling stronger, having more self-care skills by virtue of having gone through and having faced those feelings of vulnerability. So it's a paradox, really, that by facing vulnerability and by facing one's lack of control, one actually arrives paradoxically at a greater sense of peace and stability in one's life. So if you are a person who has previously had a great need for control in your life and for an intellectual understanding of everything around you, that might be something to explore further.
I did notice at the time of my mother's death that I had no feelings whatsoever. I went on autopilot and did everything perfectly by procedure, going through the motions. And I could not look at her corpse when they asked me to, because I think I was afraid of what might happen because of all of the years of repressed emotionality dealing with my conflicted parents, who I was estranged from. And they knocked on the door, you know, and when they both collapsed at once. And I had to go face these things that I'd distanced myself from by achievement.
Yes.
I think you're sharing some important insights, and we want to try to keep it a little more generalizable. But I think the question that was on the chat line about grieving is certainly something that you've addressed here. And you know, grieving, I'll give my perspective as a doctor, and then we can see what Arnold's perspective is. But grieving is a process. It's a process that people go through in different ways, and there's both personal and cultural differences in how people grieve. But I mean, it's a process that goes on for a period of time in response to the loss of a loved one, or, as Arnold mentioned, something important to you, be it a dream, a career, a profession, a job, etc. And that part of that grieving is going through very intense, sad feelings, crying, feeling down, etc., interspersed with other feelings that may, you know, temporarily lift you up, or connecting back with the loved one, and eventually there's kind of a closure that occurs where one can return to being able to talk about the loved one in some kind of balanced way and loving way, and maybe some forgiveness with those things that were less than perfect, and you know, the person returns more to a whole state. So that's my perspective on the process of grieving, just briefly. But Arnold, do you have any thoughts to that?
Thanks. I would just add also that, you know, the emotion of anger is something that needs attention as well. There are healthy and unhealthy ways of managing anger. And so if any of you out there find that you are in a state of continuing resentment or anger, that's something you would need to get a qualified person to help you with as well. Because as Sona talked about a lot, Sona was a great believer, is a great believer, that repressed anger was a major cause of TMS, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. So that's something that you know, one has to try to identify is one in a state of perpetual anger or chronic anger.
I think my inner child wasn't too happy about having to take care of my mother day and night and work constantly for 5 years straight. I didn't feel it, though.
Yeah. So, I appreciate your openness and willing to discuss this, but I think we may be getting a little too personal on this just from the perspective of what I hope to accomplish. No. So we're getting close to an hour here. And I think it was my original goal to do this for about an hour. There's so much more material we could cover. There's so many more questions that we could discuss, cases we could discuss. Maybe we'll do another one of these webinars in the near future. But I'm willing to take, if there is one more question from someone who hasn't spoken or who would like to either start with a new question or seek clarification of anything we've said, that could potentially be a way to transition us toward the toward the end of the chat.
And you can type these questions into the chat room if you'd like. It's at tmswiki.org/chat. I noticed that we have about twice as many people on the call as we do on the chat room. If you want me to unmute you, you're going to have to give me the details on how to unmute you. If you've connected via phone, just give me the last four digits of your phone number. If you've connected via the computer, tell me your username. And I'll hand it back to you, Dr. Schechter.
All right. Yeah. Well, in the meantime, I'll just I'm going to take a question here. Again, Phil prepared some questions. Some of them we've addressed so far. I'm looking to see if there's one that might be interesting to talk about as we wrap up today. Here's an interesting one. How do you deal effectively with someone who believes they have TMS that you doubt? So he's addressing this question to me as a practitioner. Well, a couple of things. First of all, there are some people, I believe, who have both a structural problem and TMS. And this is not something that I think Dr. Sarno refers to in any of his books, but it's something that I see in the real world of my practice, which is somebody may have a structural problem causing part of their problem, but there's clearly a TMS, you could say, amplification of their problem. And so that's a situation where I obviously I believe that they have TMS, but I also believe they have something else as well. And I try to work with them on both, but specifically the TMS, because I often can get the best result with that in the least invasive, non-medication, non-pharmacological way. The other thing is that patients over the years, I believe, have helped me to push my own boundaries of acceptance of TMS. And what I mean by that is there were conditions not initially delineated by Dr. Sarno at the time that I began to see them, where people said, you know, I think I might have this condition. And I've read some of these materials, I've read online, I've seen your website, whatever. And so I was open to them, and I was open to exploring with them whether we could do this work together. And in a number of cases, you know, they've surprised me in a sense that they've done better than I really thought they could do. So that's the case where I guess the patient leads the doctor, rather than vice versa. And, you know, that's then made me a better practitioner for other patients who come in with similar conditions. There are the occasional patient, it's rare, where somebody really believes they have TMS, but we get an MRI and there's something kind of horrendous on it. And just in the last few months, there was someone that I diagnosed a tumor with. Not to scare anybody, it very, very rarely happens, but, you know, he really needed a different type of treatment than I could offer. And I made sure that he was directed to the people who could deal with that structural process. And I was certainly open to work with him on, you know, other emotional issues that could be relevant. But anyway, that's my answer to the question of how I deal with people who strongly believe they have TMS, but that I doubt. Kind of the opposite of what we usually see, where I may strongly believe it and they may doubt it. Did any other questions come up at this point? Looks like we're kind of wrapping up. Arnold, do you have any final comments you'd like to make as we get close to the end here?
Well, I saw that someone in the chat room asked the question, if someone has a deep-seated feeling of undeservedness, can they ultimately heal? So the question is it possible to get over having a deep-seated feeling of being undeserving? This is a good question. I see it also as a TMS question because I think one of the things one has to look out for in this field is whether a person is walking around with a feeling of self-hatred or lack of deserving and whether they might, in a sense, be manifesting symptoms because they might have an identity that's closely linked to suffering. So being chronically sick, for example, having chronic symptoms could in some cases be a manifestation of a type of self-hatred. And there's a book that I would recommend people read. It's called Compassion and Self-Hate by Theodore Rubin. Excellent book, Compassion and Self-Hate by Theodore Rubin, MD. And he does a marvelous job of really helping people to move towards achieving a more compassionate relationship with themselves. And I would add a relationship in which suffering is not an essential part of one's identity.
Thank you, Arnold. Forrest, do you have anything to add at this point? Because I think we're going to wrap it up.
No, I just want to thank you so much for joining us. This is very interesting. I'm looking up the book as we speak.
Great. All right, you're very welcome. And Phil, thanks for being the one that really sort of inspired me or instigated, in a sense, the interest in doing this. And it's part of your learning process. And thanks for Arnold for coming on board today. And thanks for everybody who's listening today and will listen in the future, because it's an important topic, and it's certainly something that I believe can help a lot of people out there and many who haven't yet been helped by it or learned of it. So thanks very much, and good night.
Good night. Thanks, everyone.
And many thanks going around in the chat room from Chuck, guest 864, guest 507, and Honey Bear as well, and Morcom. So thanks, everyone, who joined us, and I will see you or hear you, possibly, or read you at the next event.